I live in Florida. I grew up in Florida, but most of my preaching before going back to Florida was done anywhere but that state, not because I was trying to get away from it, but just where the Lord's work took me. Florida's pretty flat. I have told some other people here already various ways of describing just how flat it is. Tallahassee's near the top of the state, Miami's at the bottom, and a person in Miami can raise their hand really high, and a person in Tallahassee can see the tips of their fingers. It's about that flat. And you have a terrain very unlike mine. I'm used to walking in the mornings. I get up and usually walk for a few miles, and Laurie was telling me, oh, I know a really good walking trail for you, without telling me that it probably should be named Everest, because that trail wasn't too bad until it took me to the foot of the mountain. And to be fair to her, she said, now, there is a hill at the end of that, and you may not want to go up that, but Glenn assured me I could make it. And halfway up, I was thinking, I'm going to have to call him for an airlift out of here, because I was sucking wind. I mean, it was really taking me to task. But I knew I had to go up or down, and down would have been harder on my knees, so I kept going up. And I made it to the top, but I didn't tackle that one this morning that same way. I left that mountain alone that way. That terrain, the difference in the terrain is very distinct. I lived in North Carolina for 13 years, and one of the beautiful things about living in North Carolina, and one of the reasons I loved calling it home, was because of its unusual geography. Where we lived, which was in the Piedmont, the middle part of the state, you could drive 3 hours to the west and you'd be in the heart of the Smoky Mountains. And you could drive 3.5 to 4 miles to the east and you'd be on the sandy beaches of North Carolina. It had everything from the mountains to the beaches. I mean, in one state, within just hours of each other, it was a very unique state for those features. And I loved living there. In Revelation chapters 13 and 14, there's a similar contrast of something that's happening on the beach and something is happening on the mountains at the same time. And the contrast, not only in geography, but the contrast in what is happening is pretty stark. If you'll go ahead and do, as I think you are, hearing your rustling, that you turn to their Bibles, in your Bibles, to chapter 13 and 14. We're going to really be concentrating on chapter 14 this evening in our lesson. And while you're doing that, thank you. Thank you so much for being here, for guests being with us tonight. Some of you have come a long way to be here, and I'm very grateful for that. And I know the saints in this congregation are grateful for your presence. You have treated me royally while I've been here already, and I, as always, thoroughly enjoy my time here with the saints. You are so kind to me. I have relished our conversations after services on the text. A number of you have come and talked about things you've noticed in the text or things that you wonder about in the text as we've gone through that. That is so gratifying. I am happy that your minds are churning and that you're wrestling with these texts, and it's fine for you to disagree with me. That is absolutely fine for you. We live in America. You have the right to be wrong. Some of you are exercising it. No, I'm teasing you about that. But it is good for us to wrestle with the text and to see what it has to say to us. So I'm very thankful that you are here this evening and we've had time to spend together. I'm loving singing with Todd. He so capably leads the Lord's people in song, and it is a great joy for us to sing like we have before the lesson and after the lesson, and I'm grateful for all that you are doing to make this a wonderful time for us to be together. In chapter 13, the dragon, who is seen by John as a dragon, it's not a figure at all, it's a real dragon to him. Though, as we said, this book is signified. So it's a sign, meaning something else. The dragon is clearly Satan in these scriptures. And the dragon has attempted to short-circuit God's plan of redemption through the man-child in chapter 12. And that doesn't work. So he pursues God's people. And in chapter 13, the dragon stands on a seashore and calls up from the sea this great beast. It is a terrifying picture for John to witness. When I was a boy, I loved monster movies. And one of the ones that would appear regularly on our television was the old black and white versions of Godzilla. And it didn't matter how many times I saw it, when that great lizard rose up out of the water and started lumbering toward Tokyo, two things entered my mind. The first was, who can stand before a creature like that? And second was, I'm glad I don't live in Tokyo, because he always went after Tokyo. But that dragon calls up this massive beast from the sea. And as I told you already, the sea represents the nations. And this beast represents the Roman Empire, this great power that Satan is going to use to assault the people of God. And Rome was used that way by Satan's forces. And then he turns to the land behind him, and I told you already, the land represents Palestine, the place where God's people live. And then John sees this. Oh, there's a lamb. A lamb. And he's already seen a lamb before, so it would be natural for him to at first think that this lamb is going to be a good thing. And then the lamb opens its mouth, and it has the voice that speaks horrifyingly like a lion. It roars, and it is the representation of the religion that should have been, that has gone bad, Judaism, which should have been a preparatory religion and faith to bring people to Christ, instead becomes a great oppressor of Christians. It's the lamb gone bad. And these are the beasts that are called up to wage war against God's people. And added to that is this mark of the beast that is given, this number 666. And this is, I believe, the name for Nero Caesar. And he is the great persecutor of the saints. Horrible stories. Read Fox's Book of Martyrs. Probably nobody was more cruel in his persecution of Christians than Nero was. Now, about the time you're thinking, well, my goodness, look at the forces of evil. What in the world can match that? Comes the contrast. These have been called up from the sea and from the land that's there. And then chapter 14 begins with this. Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000. Now, there's only one way John could know that. Number of people. And it is by being told that. I'm sure he didn't count the legs and divide by two, or even count the heads. Somebody told him, there's 144,000 of those. He seems to have, throughout this book of Revelation, guides who tell him what's going on and give him questions that feed him and steer him through all the symbols and figures that he is encountering. And I'm certain somebody said, the Lamb, he is standing there with 144,000. And then is given to him that 144,000 who have been named earlier, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. It's not a literal number. It's meant to be a figurative number for the summation. It's 1,000 times 12. And each of the tribes has 12,000 people in them. And so we have this completed number, 144,000 of the righteous followers of God. And let us now look at the nature of these. Verse 4, I'm going to jump ahead to verse 4 in the latter part of it particularly. It says, "These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb." First fruits are the early fruits on a tree. They're not necessarily the best, but they're a beginning point, the first of the harvest, which indicates there's going to be a lot more that comes behind it. It is interesting that the first gospel sermon preached was preached on the day of Pentecost, which was a feast of the first fruits or gathering in of the first of things that were to be brought before God in offering. And here are these 3,000 souls who are the precursors of you and me and all the others who have been brought into this relationship with God. These 144,000 have some identifying marks about them. So let us look at what the nature of the people who are the harvested of God are like. What are the people whom God wants to harvest and put in his baskets? What do they look like? What's the nature of them? And why is that important? Because I need to be that. If I'm not that kind of person, if I'm not living that kind of life, I'm not going to be harvested by God. So let us go back and look. Go back to verse 1. 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. So as you look at the 144,000, they have the name of God and the name of Christ, his Father and him, on their foreheads. It is written on their foreheads, inscribed in their heads. And what is the significance of that? Well, first of all, I want you to note where it is. It's on their heads. Why? Because what God wants is the mind. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. How? Romans says, by the renewing of your minds. It's fine to bring to God clean hands, but when we bring to him clean hands, and the Bible talks about that, lifting up holy hands to God in prayer, holy hands are righteous hands, they're hands that are worthy. It's our way of saying to God, look, I'm clean, my hands are clean. It's fine to do that, but that's not really what God's concerned about. He's not going to squirt us with sanitizer and make our physical bodies clean. What he wants is a clean mind, because if the mind is given to God, the body will follow. If I will live with a pure mind, my tongue will be pure. If I will live with a pure mind, my eyes will be pure. If I live with a pure mind, my hands will be doing pure things, and my feet will be walking in pure paths. The mind is the key. And so, where are these followers of the Lamb tagged? Not on their arms. It's not even over their physical hearts. It is the mind. It is on the forehead. This belongs to God and to his Christ. And what's the significance of that? Well, let's talk about marking. We know that even in the Old Testament, slaves who chose to remain in their master's service after their indentured time was up, or they were to be set free if they chose to remain, were marked with an awl against the doorpost and a puncture mark through the ear that would identify that slave as being owned by somebody. And it is true as we do with cattle. We will brand cattle to mark them as ownership possessions by a cattle owner. And in this way, it may very well be that what's being said here is these are the ones that belong to God. He marked them. He puts something on their forehead to say, this one's mine. Yep, and this one's mine too. And this one's mine. But it may be beyond that. It could be a mark of loyalty. I know some men who were in military service. And I think in particular of one brother who had been in the 101st Airborne and had tattooed on his bicep, 101st Airborne. A division commander. Roman soldiers often had the marks of their company commanders tattooed on their bodies. It was a way of saying, I'm loyal to him. It's tattooing mom on your body. I'm loyal to her. She's important to me. I want to identify with her. There is a sense in which I am giving my heart and my mind to that person. Now, I want to show you something that's an interesting contrast. Jump down to verse 9, if you would, please. In chapter 14, verse 9, another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, now that's interesting, because none of God's people are marked on the hand. None of them. God's people are marked on the forehead only. But there's a sense in which those who followed the beast could have been committed to him mentally. They could have been heart and soul working for him, or they could have been giving what we would call lip service to him. They're just saluting him. They're just branded on the hand. They're giving a loyalty of the hand and saluting him, but their hearts aren't in it. But I want to tell you something. You can't follow God and be branded on the hand. He will not accept that. You can't just do good deeds and not really be committed to him. I like him. I'm willing to follow him. He's an okay guy. You can't do that. Not with God. It's mind commitment only for him. The beast is willing to take. The dragon is willing to take those who've been marked on the hand. Serve me, that's fine. Follow me by mind, that's fine too. But I'll take either one, but not God. Not God. Which is why Jesus said, if you're not with me, you're against me. Don't try to give me any salutes like this. If you are not with me, you are against me. But this is also a mark of identification. You know, it's become pretty common for soldiers to have dog tags or for even us to micro dot animals or even children to identify them that way. And this may be just a mark of identifying who belongs to who. God is saying, this one's mine. It's not an identifying mark of slavery, but this one is under my protection. You remember in Genesis chapter 4, when Cain kills Abel, and he comes to God, and he's being sent out. You remember what he says? He says, this is more than I can bear, because every man will lift up his hand against me. They'll all want to kill me when they see me and hear what I've done. And you remember what God does to him? He places a mark on him. And what does that mark say? Don't touch this one. I don't know what the mark looked like. I don't know if it was a skull and crossbones, the original, or I'm bad to the bone or what. I don't know. I don't know what it said. But when people saw it, they recognized it as a mark of God. They backed off. And Cain lives a long life because God has marked him and said, cut him out from everybody else. He is under my protection. And that may be significant in chapter 14 because there is going to be a terrible, wrath-filled harvest and judgment that is taking place. And God may be marking those who should be spared. You know how we do that with trees in a forest? they'll mark trees. Don't cut this one down. Don't cut this one down. God may be saying, when you angels start slaughtering the wicked in this vision, don't touch the ones who are marked on the forehead. Let's go to verse 2. I heard a voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. Isn't that an interesting contrast? We can't even imagine what that might have sounded like. Many waters, but harps. Thunder, but harps. Nobody ever listened to a harpist and said, oh, I'm reminded of thunder. Nobody ever did that. But this has this quality, both of being pervasive and loud and foreboding, and yet at the same time, to those who are being spared and to the righteous, it's beautiful music. The sound of harpists playing on their harps. And verse 3, and they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they've kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. All right. My Jehovah Witness friends often talk about the 144,000, and they will refer to them here. These are the chosen ones of God, the 144,000. And I will say, I have said and have brought them up short by saying, any women in the 144,000? Well, yeah, of course there are. No, they can't be the 144,000 if they're women. If that's a literal statement, they can't be women. It says, these have not been defiled with women. They've kept themselves chaste. These are virgin men. And then I say, have they lied? The 144,000, have they ever lied? Well, everybody lies. That doesn't justify it, but we all do. In fact, if I ask you here, raise your hand. If you've lied, you don't raise your hand. You just did. We've all done that. But the point is, these have not lied. In fact, they're called blameless here. And they are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. What is being said here? It's not literal. It isn't literal. The 144,000 isn't literal. You can't take that as literal and then not take the rest of it as literal. The 144,000 is a full number of those people whom God is rescuing from this destructive harvesting that are his own. And what makes them his own? Well, a couple of things. First of all, I want you to note, they sing a new song. They don't sing the new song. It's not the one in your songbooks. It's not that. And if you're thinking, hey, I'm in, that's the wrong song. That's the new song, and it's not new anymore, because we've been singing it for decades. But this is called a new song for a reason. It is a song that only the righteous are able to sing. It is new in that it has only been brought into being through Jesus Christ and his redemptive work. A new song. And the righteous sing it. So if you're thinking, I don't really like the new song, the one in the books. I don't want to sing that for eternity. You don't have to. That's not the one that's being talked about here. But it is a song of great redemption, and only the righteous can sing it. Those who are not part of this number can't sing it because they don't even know it. And I think there's an important point, somewhat tangential, but I want to make this point. Listen. We can't expect the world to understand how we live. The world will never understand what motivates us and how we live and why some things are important to us and other things are not important to us at all. The world cannot understand that. It's like singing a song and asking them to join in, and they don't have the words and they don't have the music and they've never heard it before. They can't do that. And we shouldn't be getting frustrated that the world can't sing our songs. I speak figuratively. I'm not talking about physical songbooks. But if the world can't join in the rejoicing of the saints, don't be discouraged about that. That's the way it was intended to be. They were never meant to sing our songs. But I'll tell you what our goal is, to teach them the songs. To teach them the things that motivate us, that move us as people, the values that we have that this world doesn't appreciate and doesn't know. Teach that to the people of the world so that one day, like that old Coca-Cola commercial, I want to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. That's what our goal is. To help them learn the new song of redemption in Jesus Christ. Second, they are virgins. They not only sing a song nobody else knows, they're virgins. What does that mean? Well, they're pure. It isn't a reference, though it is clearly a symbolic reference here. It's not a reference to their sexual purity. Marriage is to be honored by all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. There is nothing wrong with sexual relations between a husband and wife. This is not to say virgins are better than those who are married, but it is this. Listen, here's the point. Virginity is an absolute statement. There's no halfway. You can't say, if somebody asked a question, I don't know that anybody has a right to ask us this question, but if they did, are you a virgin? You can't say, kinda. You can't. You either are or you aren't. And in this picture, they either are with Christ or they aren't. It is an absolute, you're with me or you're not with me. There's no halfway. There's no straddling it. There is no semi-virginity on anybody's part. They are wholly committed to Jesus. There is no in-between for them. They are virgins, wholly committed to their God. And they are pure in speech. No lie is found in their mouths. What does that mean? Well, we've talked about that in, I'm sure, many sermons about the tongue being the hardest member of our bodies to tame. And that if we can tame the tongue, then the whole body falls into place, because this one's a hard one. That. And so if they've got that under control, they got control. No lie found in their mouths. They are blameless. And then one more mark that's found further down, verses 12 and 13. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. Faithful until death. You know, we use that phrase all the time. We use it at funerals all the time. And I'm not opposed to using it that way. I've used it that way myself. But I want to tell you something. In its literal context, it's not just being faithful till you die. It's being faithful to the point of being put to death. In its context, that's what it means. It's not just be faithful until you die of old age or a disease or an accident. It's not that. Though that's important. And I think we all need to do that. Live until we die. Live for Christ until that moment we die. But this statement about being faithful to death is be faithful even to the point of not denying Christ if they kill you. It is the classic renounce Christ or die.
and we say, you'll have to kill me. That's the faithful till death that's being discussed in the book of Revelation. And these are willing to die for the master. They're willing to die, even for their Christ. So the harvester. There's the harvested people. Are you ready to be harvested? Are you living your life in the way that we just talked about? So that if Christ came, you'd point to your forehead and say, there, look, I got the mark. I'm there. I'm with you. I'm one of the righteous. Take me. Harvest me, Lord. And if you'd say, no, I'm not sure I'm there, then you better get ready, because I'm going to tell you something. A harvest is coming. There is coming a time when all the earth shall be reaped, and the righteous shall be set aside, and the wicked shall perish. And here is a picture of a similar situation in the scriptures. So what can we learn from it? Well, let's go back and look. Verse 14. I looked, and behold, a white cloud. Now, I hope we've been in Revelation long enough that you're already triggering. Oh, clouds, got it. I know who's here. This is judgment. But this one's interesting. It's a white cloud. This is the only time you'll see a white cloud in the book of Revelation. What do white clouds tend to indicate? You don't look at white clouds and say, oh, bad storm coming. This is not a bad situation. This is going to be a good situation. And if you live in a desert region, white clouds are really good, because they're going to provide you some shade. So this is a good cloud at this point. John sees this great white cloud, and he thinks, oh good, this isn't bad. And he's right, this is not bad. And behold, sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man. Don't be thrown off by that. Well, it can't be the son of man. It says like a son of man. No, this is a picture. This is signified. It's a sign given to him. He has the appearance of a man, but he has a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. So here, sitting on this cloud, riding on the clouds, is this man figure with a crown on his head. He's a king, and he's got a sickle in his hand. White cloud, purity. It's a peaceful coming. And he is a king. In Matthew chapter 20, there's the parable given about a king who has a vineyard. In chapter 20, beginning in verse 25, Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 25, Jesus called him and said, you know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for the many. That passage is telling us the nature of King Jesus is different than the nature of other kings. I'll give you a contrast. I've always found this fascinating. I don't know how many of you know that the one era of Chinese rulers were called the Mandarins. And they weren't oranges. They were kings. And the Mandarins had this custom of growing their fingernails as long as they possibly could. They didn't cut them at all. They carefully manicured them. And if you, I don't know if any of you have ever grown fingernails this long. I haven't, but I've seen pictures of them. When your fingernails grow a certain length, they start corkscrewing. They will start twisting. And they can get very brittle the longer they get. And there are pictures of some of the Mandarins, and they're holding their hands out, and they've got these long fingernails. And it got to the point where, in order to keep them from breaking off, they put gold shields over the top of them, so that they wouldn't break off, and they protected them that way. And there was something, it was so debilitating to them, they got to the point where they couldn't feed themselves. They couldn't hold anything. Look, you've seen that. You've seen women who have those long fingernails, and they're trying to touch a telephone, and they are struggling to punch the telephone because the nails won't do it, and they're trying to get the pad on it,
and the nails are click, click, clicking. They can't type because their nails are too long. The mandarins got to the point where they couldn't feed themselves. I guess about the only thing they could do was scratch their backs. But they had to be fed. And you may wonder, why would they do that? That's the very point. You can't live a life of working with your hands and have fingernails like that. It was a badge of honor. I don't do anything. I don't work. I don't even feed myself. I couldn't have these nails if I did. Jesus is not like that. He's not a king like that. He rolls up his sleeves and he gets to work. Here he comes. He's got a crown on his head. And that's a little incongruous picture there. Jesus has a crown on his head and a sickle in his hand. Who goes out into a field to sickle down wheat with a crown on their head? First of all, if it's in the sun, it's going to leave a really unsightly white mark around his forehead when the rest of his face gets tanned. But Jesus is trying to say something here. God is saying something about the working nature of the Son of God. He is a working king. He is not too haughty to work the fields. And he wields a sickle. He is going to harvest his own. There is a time designated for the harvest. I don't know when that is. But God's got it on a calendar. There is going to come a time when God says, it's time to harvest. There is a great day coming. And as that song that we sometimes sing says, but its greatness shall only come to those or to them that love the Lord. It is sometimes hard for me when I hear brothers in their prayers say, Lord, come quickly. Because I'm afraid if the Lord came very quickly, there'd be a lot of people who just wouldn't be ready to be harvested. There are times when I'm not sure I'm that ready. And he is going to put his sickle to the harvest. And listen, it says, another angel, verse 15, came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come. Notice that. The hour has come. Somebody's watching that stopwatch, and they said, now it's time. The calendar was peeled off, and the day came, and it said, time to harvest. And nothing's going to stop that or turn it back. Because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Literally, that statement is the harvest of the earth has become dry. It is time to sickle the harvest. And another angel, verse 18, also had a sharp sickle, verse 17. The one who has power over fire, in verse 18, came out from the altar. And he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle. Gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth, and threw them, listen to this phrase, threw them into the great wine press of the wrath of God. And the wine press was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the wine press up to the horse's bridle, for a distance of 200 miles. These are not grapes. These are people. And they're being plucked up from the earth as that angel, not this time the king, but now his servants who go in and reap the second part of that harvest. This is not a reference to the rapture and some future judgment. This is simply the separation where Jesus takes his own all the dead shall be raised, John tells us, some to a resurrection of life and some to a resurrection of destruction. Jesus has harvested his own who had his mark on their foreheads and gathered them to himself, and the other angels go into the fields and take what is left and cast them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And as they are twisting down the winepress onto the bodies of those, symbolic, signified, not literal, grape juice doesn't come out. Blood pours out from the staves of that wine press and pours down a valley that is as high as a horse's bridle and 200 miles long of blood. Folks, I'm going to tell you something. There isn't that much blood in the world. I was a firefighter, and I remember on one occasion going to a class that we had to take, and it was a class on emergency medical treatment. I wasn't an EMT, but we had to learn some of the basic medical treatments for people. And so one of the things that they did is they showed us a picture, and it was a picture of a woman lying on the grass, and she was covered in blood. And they said, what do you think? You arrive on the scene, this is what you see, what do you think? And a number of us said, she's got to be dead. She can't have any blood in her body at all at this point. Look at her, she is covered in it. And he said, that's what you typically think when you come across a scene like that. You're going to be absolutely shocked. You're going to think, there is no way there could be that much blood in her body. And it was a scant amount of blood. It was only a matter of 2 pints of blood, fake blood. It was put on her body, only 2 pints. But listen, how many pints of blood do you have to be 5 feet high, 200 miles long? This is an incredible number. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. What John sees is not, oh yeah, I saw a bad accident one time. It was about like that. Nobody's ever seen this kind of blood. No doctor's ever seen this kind of blood. No blood bank has ever seen 200 miles of blood. What is being said? What's being said here? In the 1960s, the United States and the Soviet Union reached an impasse in their accumulation of nuclear weapons and their threats to use them against each other with what was called then the MAD policy, mutually assured destruction. The idea was nobody in America and nobody in the Soviet Union would push the button to launch those missiles because it was guaranteed the destruction would be so vast, so permanent, so worldwide that nobody had the courage to push that button. Nobody. And they were right. Nobody did. No Russian premier, no American president ever pushed the button and said, this is it. Because they knew the consequences of that were too grave for any human to assume the responsibility for. God is not afraid to push that button. He is not afraid to reach that point where he says, okay, that's it. It's over. And he will not hesitate but there are so many people that are going to be lost if I do that. If I call for the harvest, millions of people will be lost. I just don't know if I can push that button. That is not our God. And that's the very message that's being given here in chapter 14. Our God will push the button. He is not afraid. He will take the consequences. He has the courage to call in the game. He has the courage and the stomach to do just that. We may not, but do not underestimate God's determination
to destroy wickedness and reward righteousness. This is the Lord of the harvest. This is the Jesus of Revelation chapter 14. There is a great day coming, but its greatness shall only come to those that love the Lord. And for others, there is this horribly sad, tragic day when they will hear their doom proclaimed. I did not know you. Are you ready? Are you ready for that harvest? Are you prepared when the Lord calls this world to an end? If you're alive, are you ready to say, Lord, come quickly? Because if you're not, you need to get into Christ tonight. You need to give this mind to Him. You need to have His name on your forehead. You need to give yourself lock, stock, and barrel, heart, soul, mind, and strength to Jesus Christ. It's the only way to escape the judgment that is to come. Live a pure life and be blameless. Commit yourself wholly, even as a virgin would be committed to that lifestyle. Commit yourself to a life of purity in Jesus Christ. This is no small matter. This is no trite matter we're discussing. This is not even life and death. This is heaven and hell. This is eternally consequential. Don't miss being in the Lord's harvest rather than that of those who suffer the great winepress of the wrath of God. If we can help you, we sure want to pray with you. We want to study with you. We want to see you put on Christ. In the waters of baptism, wash away your sins. Come, name Jesus as the Lord of harvest for you while we stand and sing this song. You come. I heard the